If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Cryptocurrency crashes, but is it a threat to the broader economy? And the House January 6th committee issues subpoenas to 5 Republican lawmakers, including Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleague, columnist Kim Strassel. Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Happy Friday, Kyle.
So the stock market has had another volatile week after the April inflation data came out. The S&P 500 fell 1.5%. The NASDAQ fell about 3%, and now in trading today so far, it's regained some of that. S&P is up 2.2%, the NASDAQ is up 3.7%. And another part of the story, aside from inflation here, is this crash in cryptocurrency. The price of Bitcoin is about half of what it used to be, and the journal says that trading has wiped out more than $1 trillion of digital currency value since November. And this all comes, as we are aware of, while there's a lot of bubbles in the market, it seems like, meme stocks going on. And so, Kim, is there a risk of some broader economic contagion as the Federal Reserve raises rates, raises the cost of borrowing to deal with inflation?
Well, what happened in the crypto market this week is certainly freaking some people out and making people wonder if this isn't the beginning of some wider contagion. And let's hope not. But what we have here is the hundreds of these digital currencies that have been created in just the last couple of years. The market for cryptocurrencies has gone from about $500 billion to about $2.9 trillion in the space of about 18 months. And obviously, the problem with some of these virtual currencies is that while we largely operate in a world overall of fiat currencies, things like the dollar are backed by governments, whereas cryptocurrencies are pretty much backed by faith in their developers. And so, as we've now seen the Fed tighten, credit is suddenly becoming much harder. This has spooked a bunch of people that are in this market. They're withdrawing. There's now real questions about what would happen if some of these went into bankruptcy. There's a risk not just of market contagion inside the cryptocurrency world, the collapse of other currencies, a domino effect if this begins to fall out. But there's also a risk that this also bleeds into the banking system overall, in that cryptos often investors use these currencies to sort of disintermediate financial institutions. They claim you don't need a bank or a broker to make transactions. But the credit that you have to buy crypto has to come from somewhere. And so this could be a draw in that regard on some of those financial institutions, and it risks having more of a fallout beyond just the crypto market.
And especially in an environment, a financial environment, where rates are going up and they're expected to continue to go up. There's an old Warren Buffett saying that I like. He has said that it's only when the tide goes out that you find out who's swimming naked. And the worry is that if interest rates go as high as they need to tame this inflation, that half the economy might soon be looking like a nude beach. And so let's hope, Kim, that Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has it in him to break this inflation. On Thursday, the Senate gave him a second 4-year term in his job. It was a vote of 80-19. And here's what Mr. Powell told the Marketplace radio show, quote, "The process of getting inflation down to 2% will also include some pain, but ultimately the most painful thing would be if we were to fail to deal with it. Ultimately, we'd have to go through a much deeper downturn," unquote. And Kim, I think that's the right answer, but that answer becomes harder and harder to give the more ugly that the economy starts to look.
Yeah, I'm moderately hopeful that this vote to confirm Jerome Powell for a second term will perhaps at least give him a little bit more freedom in his mind to do what he wants. We all like to think that the Fed is immune from politics. We all know that that is not the case. And there's been a lot of suspicion as Democrats held for a long time this renomination over his head, and then the long waiting period for him to actually get a vote, that some of Powell's actions were designed in a small way to curry favor with a Democratic Congress that clearly wanted the Fed to continue to keep money cheap because it helped them in their whole agenda of throwing money out the door as part of their stimulus when they first came in, and obviously an expectation that they might get their Build Back Better agenda. So now he's firmly in place, and it'll be curious to see where he next goes and what he next says, because he's been all over the map the last couple of months. He came out a while ago and sounded pretty hawkish, then a little bit more dovish, sometimes a little more hawkish again. The reality is, Kyle, as you said, that with the numbers we're seeing right now, especially this week's latest CPI and PPI numbers that suggest that inflation is not going away, he is going to have to be more aggressive. And that might mean a series of half point rate hikes with more frequency than the Fed had initially conceived.
Meanwhile, one place that inflation is good for business is at the Internal Revenue Service. And I just wanted to note a couple of figures in an editorial that the Journal has today on this, citing numbers from the Congressional Budget Office. Federal tax receipts through April are up 39% from a year earlier, and individual income taxes are up 68%. Some of that is economic growth, recovery from the pandemic, but some of that, of course, Kim, is inflation. And tax brackets are adjusted for inflation, but my understanding is that only happens periodically. And there's been a lot when inflation rates are this high, there's some inflation in between those adjustments. And of course, capital gains taxes are not adjusted for inflation. And so inflation is good for the government, even if it's not good for individual people and businesses.
Inflation is great for the government. Also, Democrats are hoping it's good for politics. If you've been watching Joe Biden, his message consistently over the last couple of weeks, he's just been hammering it, is, oh, look at, I'm actually lowering the deficit. I am cutting spending. This is a bunch of nonsense. What's really been happening is that if spending looks like it's way down this year, it's only because Congress so blew the bank in the two prior years, putting out these huge, huge spending bills to deal with the pandemic. And now we are returning somewhat more to a pre-pandemic levels. And so that has looked as though spending has been on the wane. But the other reason, as you noted, is federal receipts are simply booming. Individual income taxes rose 68%. Corporate income taxes up 21%. And this, as you note, a big reason for it is inflation. As people get stuck into much higher tax brackets, I think is when it's explained to them as well, too, that it's kind of a double whammy, as it were. Pay more for your groceries and pay more in your taxes, which the federal government will then spend, potentially making inflation worse.
On Capitol Hill, the show on Thursday was an attempt in the Senate to quickly pass a $40 billion aid bill for Ukraine, which was blocked when Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky objected. And here is part of what he said.
My oath of office is to the U.S. Constitution, not to any foreign nation. And no matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the United States of America. We cannot save Ukraine by dooming the U.S. economy. In March, inflation hit a 40-year high. Gasoline alone is up 48%, and energy prices are up 32% over the last year. Food prices have increased by nearly 9%. Used vehicle prices are up 35% for the year, and new vehicle prices have increased 12% or more. Yes, inflation doesn't just come out of nowhere. It comes from deficit spending.
And here's a piece you can listen to with the response from the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer.
It's clear from the junior senator from Kentucky's remarks, he doesn't want to aid Ukraine. That is not the case for the overwhelming majority here. Again, all he will accomplish with his actions here today is to delay that aid, not to stop it. It's aid desperately needed by a valiant people fighting against authoritarianism and defending democracy.
Kim, what do you make of this back and forth?
Well, by the way, this is classic Rand Paul. Anyone who has spent any time in Washington, this is what Rand Paul does. He's rock-ribbed libertarian, which is another way in some forums to say he doesn't have necessarily an entirely coherent foreign policy agenda. He's very skeptical of spending overall, which is a good thing, but particularly so when it comes to supplying foreign aid. He's much more a guy who thinks that the priority should be entirely on domestics. I agree, by the way, that this bill should be passed. And I would note that the $40 billion that is going out the door to Ukraine is a drop in the bucket compared to what Congress joined hands and passed, the more than $12 trillion in spending in fiscal 2021 for the pandemic. The funny thing about Rand Paul is that it didn't have to be this way. He was actually offered the opportunity to attach an amendment to the bill that would give him what he wanted. And what he wants is an inspector general to look into how this money is being spent and making sure that it is spent effectively and wisely. And by the way, that's a sentiment that actually does have support on both sides of the aisle in the Senate, and it likely would have passed. Instead, he demanded that it be put in as part of the underlying bill, something that would have added a very long time to the process of this, in that the House has already passed it. So you would have to modify the bill, have the House pass it again, then send it to the Senate. It was going to add time. This is going to pass. All it means is that Chuck Schumer needs to go through some procedural hoops to basically overcome his objection. And then it'll pass with huge bipartisan majorities, which to me is the much bigger story, is that this passed with overwhelming support in the House, overwhelming support in the Senate, because it's a rare and good to see a rare cause that is creating some bipartisan unity.
Well, I won't quarrel with the idea of an inspector general to oversee how this Ukraine aid is spent, although I would note that Congress can also provide that kind of oversight. And as far as the inflation concern that he raises, it seems to be unlikely that sending guns to Ukraine, sending ammunition to Ukraine, is going to meaningfully affect the inflation that we're seeing. I don't think it's what caused the inflation in the first place, but certainly in the short term, I don't see how sending some howitzers to Ukraine is going to have an inflation effect. Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. The other big news Thursday was from the January 6th Select Committee in the House, and it has subpoenaed five House Republicans. They are Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Congressman Jim Jordan, Scott Perry, Mo Brooks, and Andy Biggs. And here's a piece of what Andy Biggs said responding to that subpoena.
Well, I think this is an illegitimate committee, that and they don't really have the authority to issue subpoenas, in my opinion. So we don't want to dignify what they're doing. This has been a witch hunt from day one. This is an attempt to go after political enemies instead of trying to get at the truth.
Kim, what do you think of the debate over these subpoenas? The January 6th committee had asked these congressmen to voluntarily testify. One of the things it is interested in related to McCarthy is this phone call that McCarthy had, apparently sort of during the Capitol riot on January 6th. I still don't understand why he doesn't voluntarily explain to the committee what that phone call consisted of. But now we have a subpoena here. And the question, I think, is how and is the House going to try to move against McCarthy to enforce this?
So here's the problem. I think that this is a really unfortunate commentary on the position and the status of the committee itself. Because look, do we want a body to dispassionately investigate what happened on January 6th and provide some answers to the country? Absolutely. The problem is that Democrats have made it all too easy for Republicans to view this committee as a partisan body that is more interested in scoring partisan points than it is in getting to the facts of anything. And look, I mean, from the beginning, from the way it started, when Nancy Pelosi created a committee that was stacked in favor of Democrats, she then vetoed McCarthy's picks to it. The committee has unfortunately over the past year become this font of leaks, some of them very dubious, including a whole raft of nasty leaked text messages from Ginny Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, who has nothing to do with the real question of what happened on January 6th. It seemed an intent to smear. And all this has done has made it much easier for Republicans to say that this is a partisan body. And then now you have yet another unprecedented step of the committee issuing subpoenas to sitting House members. We have had a House Ethics Committee that has very, very rarely issued subpoenas. Those subpoenas have been focused on conduct outside of legislative work, clear accusations of corruption. This would be the first time anybody had ever demanded or subpoenaed someone to come and talk about what the members will certainly argue is their actions that were taken as part of their legislative duties. I think that they will probably refuse to comply. And then you get a complex situation where the committee would have to decide whether or not to hold them in contempt and refer this to the Department of Justice. And then you have a major litigation over whether or not the Department of Justice even has the authority to prosecute them.
Well, I take those criticisms of the January 6th committee on board, and I think they're valid. I mean, I wish the committee would do its investigating and hold its information until it's ready to release a report or something like that. On the other hand, I'm still hoping that the committee can answer some of the unanswered questions surrounding January 6th. And I do think that some of the information they've released so far is helpful, is interesting information. And one thing I would point to is these text messages to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. There's one on November 6th from Jason Miller, a Trump aide. And he says this: POTUS received 15.5% of the vote in Philadelphia County in 2016. Today, he is currently at 18.3%. So he increased his performance from 2016. He goes on to say that Philadelphia in 2016, Philadelphia County made up 11.3% of the total state vote. As it currently stands, Philadelphia County only makes up 10.2% of the state vote. And then he says, POTUS performed better in a smaller share, cuts hard against the urban vote stealing narrative, unquote. And I think that is a fascinating piece of information that you had a high-level Trump aide 3 days after the election explaining facts on the ground that cut against the electoral fraud, stolen election theories that President Trump has been making ever since. On the other hand, I do agree that this is a potentially dangerous step of subpoenaing members of the other party, and particularly the minority leader. And the way that the House has tried to enforce previous subpoenas, for example, the one against Steve Bannon, the House held a vote to hold him in criminal contempt. And then the question is whether the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, is going to prosecute that person. But the context is entirely different. I mean, imagine the Justice Department prosecuting the minority leader, the leader of the other party in the House, because he doesn't want to disclose what was said in a conversation that the leader of the other party had with the president of the other party. Is there any prospect that we're really going to go down that road, Kim?
Well, it seems as though we are. And, you know, the committee would point out that while they have made this decision to issue the subpoenas, that they felt that they had no choice, that the decision on whether or not, if they were not complied with, to hold people in contempt and refer to DOJ is an entirely different step and one that no decisions have been made on yet. But here's my fear, though, Kyle, is if the argument from the committee is we had no choice and we can't just let these people thumb their nose at us, we had voluntarily asked them to come in and they wouldn't. Well, if they now thumb their nose at them again, isn't all the impulse going to be to, in fact, go down that road and throw us into this uncharted new territory yet again, precedents just being broken right and left? If DOJ were to prosecute, the members would argue that the conversations and information that the committee is seeking was part of the members' actions with regard to pursuing the Electoral Count Act, which was obviously what was going on the day of the riot, and therefore is protected from litigation or prosecution under Congress's speech and debate clause. I mean, this could be a years-long lawsuit, which doesn't serve anyone. But the other thing, Kyle, which I think is much more an immediate threat, a bigger problem is, again, up until now, you had the House Ethics Committee, mostly to the extent you ever had a subpoena of a member. The committee is set up to actually work in a bipartisan fashion. It has equal members on both sides. If you greenlight a majority committee like this one, where Democrats are in control, to start hauling people in to give testimony, it's a green light for every committee chairman in any Congress to do that. And if you don't think that Kevin McCarthy has a list already of Democrats he'd love to haul in with subpoenas in front of committees to talk about Hunter Biden, or Jim Jordan, who's one of the members who's going to be running the Judiciary Committee someday, you're being very naive. So this is a very bad precedent for, it's going to be a retaliatory subpoena bonfire.
And in terms of escalation, there is always the other option, which is that Congress has its own inherent contempt power. And so there are some conservatives who argued that when the IRS official Lois Lerner would not give Congress the information it wanted and the Justice Department was not going to prosecute that, that Congress, the House, the Senate could have done their own action to hold that person in contempt and to jail them essentially in the House. And there's always that option. On the other hand, one of the problems with that, with someone like Lois Lerner or Steve Bannon, is does the House have authority to go find and get that person if that person is in another state? Who would go do that? Does the sergeant in arms have the ability and authority to do that? That's a little bit different situation here, because the House pretty much knows where Kevin McCarthy is, and a lot of times he's in the House, he's on the floor. On the other hand, it is hard to imagine, you know, House police force taking Kevin McCarthy into custody too. So, Kim, what is the final outcome that you foresee here? Is it likely that these Republicans will refuse to comply with the subpoenas, and then that will be the end of it?
Well, can I just point out that one issue, it may seem a little esoteric, but what you just mentioned kind of gets onto one of the bigger problems with the conduct of this committee overall, which is that congressional committees have a power to investigate. They're meant to be investigating things in a way that furthers the legislative purpose, right? Sometimes that's an oversight, et cetera. One of the problems with this committee is that on a lot of occasions in the last year, it's instead looked as though it's positioning itself as a kind of quasi Department of Justice organization rooting out criminality. And that makes everything very weird. And that kind of gets to your point, like, is it really going to go and deputize and march Kevin McCarthy off to the jail that they have and sort of act like an enforcer here rather than an inquiring body? And we can argue about whether or not it should have protected its contempt forces and powers more. But I think the bigger question here is this what we really want Congress doing? And that's been one of the concerns and frustrations, I think, of some of the Republicans, is that this organization, it doesn't necessarily seem to be simply focused on a fact-finding mission, but engaged to a certain degree in actions that look to be aimed to put people in prison or to engage them in disciplinary proceedings. And that's kind of concerning.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch. Stay tuned. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. You can also check out the Journal's newest opinion podcast. That's called Free Expression. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.